All right. Well, I guess we look pretty full, so I'm going to get started now. Don't think anybody's going to come in late, because there aren't that many seats for anybody to come in and take. So anyway, the problem of evil. Well, that's something I'm sure most of you have never considered or heard about before. So let me explain it a little bit. There's evil. And that's sort of puzzling. Here's one way of putting the question. Why exactly does God allow evil? But now I've gotten ahead of myself. Before we get on to answering that question, as I'm going to do not here answer that question, I'll say a little bit about how you might try and answer the question next time. Here I'm going to want to address a different question, namely, okay, so we have this question about evil. What does that tell us about the rationality of theism? Do we have an answer to this question? Is the answer just that, no, God doesn't exist, that's why there's evil? Or is there an answer that we can give? If we can't give an answer, what does that tell us about theism? Do we need an answer? Those are the sort of questions I'm going to be addressing here. Okay, let's jump into exactly what sort of problem is the problem of evil. Now, it's important, I think, to notice, especially if you're interested in the problem of evil, not simply from a philosophical standpoint where you're interested in, say, the rationality of theism, but from an apologetic standpoint where you want to deal with people on the street, in your workplace, or wherever you might encounter people who are curious about the problem of evil. If that's what you're interested in, then it's important that you need to, it's important to know there's different sorts of problems. So evil, sometimes the problem of evil is the problem of why me, God? Why did this happen to me? And what the person really wants is some sort of explanation. Or what they want is something that can allow them to trust in God. They feel betrayed, they feel angry, they feel upset. The problem isn't a problem about the rationality of belief in God. The problem is a problem about how they feel towards God, or how they are going to make sense of their life in the aftermath of evil. Okay, now we're going to focus on the intellectual problems here. I may have something to say about the existential problems in Q&A if you would like, but my primary focus here is on the intellectual problem. Now, I'll say a bit more about that, but first, one of the things to note about the intellectual problem is that if you don't, if the problem of evil doesn't provide good reasons to disbelieve in God's existence, there probably just aren't any. With all due respect to, things like Dawkins's ultimate Boeing 747 gambit or whatever he calls it, it's a terrible argument. Most of the other arguments you hear about why God doesn't exist, because evolution and stuff, or religious wars and stuff, are so mind-numbingly terrible as arguments that they really only require a response because people want responses to them. If there's any really good rational reason to believe in God, it's either the problem of evil or reasons that I think are pretty easily dispatched, or else very technical, and just not the sort that you're going to be encountering. Okay. So, basically, this is it. This is the argument and the problem for belief in God. And if it doesn't work, then the best that atheists can hope for is a draw. Okay. So that's an overview. Back again to the question of what is the problem. As I've said, there's different sorts of the problem. But I want to start with how you're going to encounter the problem when you encounter it sort of in everyday life. You're going to find someone who's going to ask a question like, if God is loving, if God is good, if God is whatever, why is there so much evil? Now, it's a tough question to answer. But simply not being able to answer the question doesn't pose a problem for theism. Consider the following question: why did God create a world with so many stars? I mean, why not a few more? Why not way more? Why not way less? Why so many trees? Why so many snowflakes? Or if you want a more exact parallel, if God is a sense of humor, why are there so many Adam Sandler movies? If you don't think that rationality requires an answer to these questions, or rationality of theism requires an answer to these questions, then simply giving the question, hey, why is there so much evil if God exists? Why is there so much evil if God exists and is good? Why is it? Doesn't provide an objection either. Now, that's not to say that the problem of evil is as trivial as these. There is what we can call the argument from evil. And that's something we do need to address, and then that's one of the ways in which it's different. But you got to give an argument. You can't simply ask the question and be like, problem done, drop the mic, walk away, theism's dead. Doesn't work like that. Okay. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard this either in something that, either in one of these sessions today, or in Bob Stewart's class, or somewhere along the line. But arguments, the sort of thing that you have to give if you want the problem of evil to undermine theism, is going to be something that has premises, something that has conclusions. And if it's going to be a good argument, if it's going to work at undermining the rationality of theism, the premises need to give you some reason to accept the conclusion. Okay. Now, as I've said before, one of the things you need to be clear on is that when somebody asks you the question, why is there so much evil in the world, they aren't necessarily asking you for a response to an argument. And so as an apologist, rather than someone who's just doing philosophy, that's something you need to keep an eye out for. And it's going to take some discernment to tell whether somebody's asking for you to solve a rational problem or whether they're asking for you to solve existentially emotional problems. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that this is something just for philosophers. Because oftentimes, people's existential and emotional doubt is tied up in and coupled with their rational doubt. As someone once said, the heart cannot believe what the mind doubts, or something to that effect. But what your heart loves, what you're able to settle yourself with, whether you're able to trust God, whether you're able to get past any anger or whatnot that you have at God for allowing these things to happen to you when evil befalls you, will depend in large part on whether you believe that evil is compatible with the goodness of God, whether the goodness of God somehow rules this out. These things are going to be pretty closely linked in a lot of cases. And so you need to have more than just, well, you know, let me try and address your existential needs or your emotional needs. That's not going to do it. Okay? Not all by itself, not in a lot of cases. So let's get on. The perhaps original problem of evil that the Christian tradition encountered is this one. If God exists, he created everything that exists, or everything that was created, at least. Evil exists, so if God exists, God created evil. But if God created evil, then God is evil. And so if God exists, then God is evil. And clearly this is not something any theist, and especially any Christian, wants to say. Now, if you were coming in here thinking you were going to hear a lot about privation, well, here's privation for you. And this is Augustine's argument. He famously argued that two, namely evil exists, is mistaken. Evil isn't a thing that exists. Rather, evil is the absence of something. It's the absence of good, or the absence of a certain sort of good. Okay? So, what's going on is that people commit actions, or there are states, or there are events that lack goodness, or lack the sort of goodness that we would want them to have. Okay? Now, that does, I think, solve the problem of created evil. If that's what you want to say, then there you go. That argument's going to be finished, and there's not going to be much way to resurrect it. Here's the problem. Why? Why are these not good things? Why do people do bad things? Why are there events that cause suffering? All these things. As I have here, wars still occur, children still get molested, death still separates us from our loved ones. And saying that evil is like cold, or like a shadow, or like any of these other absences we might think of, doesn't solve this problem. Any more than saying that ice is just the, or cold is just the absence of heat, makes this image any less puzzling to us. Looks like if there's heat there, there shouldn't be ice. It looks like if God's love permeates the world, looks like if God created the world and is good, we still want to know what the evil is doing here. So this leads to perhaps the most famous version of the problem of evil, which is that there's just a contradiction here. Or so the argument goes. And it says, look, start out with the assumptions that we all have about God. He exists. He's omnipotent. He's wholly good. And there's evil. Contradiction. So, when we get a contradiction, we've got to give up one of the things that contradicts the others. And the what we should give up, or so this argument would have us believe, is the assumption that God exists. Okay? And so this is, as I know here, the traditional one. This is put forward by J.L. Mackey. One obvious problem, which I'm sure you've all noticed at this point, is that we're missing the assumption that God is omniscient. But add that assumption in, the argument's still not going to be any good, I think. What's the problem? Well, the problem is there just isn't really a contradiction, right? So what we're supposed to have this idea of God, we're supposed to have this idea of evil, and we think about them both, we think about the world having both of them, and we're just supposed to see that that can't happen. It's like saying, think about the world having exactly 6 donkeys in it. Now think about it also having exactly 7 donkeys in it. You just think, that can't happen. It's got to be one or the other. Take your pick. But now something odd happens if we just begin with a different assumption. Assume that certain great goods require some minor evil, right? So like the evil of stubbing your toe. Assume that God exists. Assume he's omnipotent. Assume he's wholly good. Okay, so we've started with those assumptions. Does it seem like we can conclude that if God made the world, he'd make a world that was completely absent of this minor evil, this toe stuff? That doesn't seem right. It seems like the opposite conclusion would be justified. God's in the business of creating good worlds, we might think, of getting goods for the creatures he loves. So if it takes a minor toe stubbing here and there, well, then that's what's got to be the case. So what I want to point out here is I'm not saying all evils are, say, minor toe stubbings. But if this is just a contradiction between God's existence on the one hand and the existence of evil on the other, then it's a contradiction between any sort of evil in God's existence, including, say, minor toe stubs. But if we can give a story, any story, on which God would have a reason to allow a minor toe stubbing, then there just isn't going to be a contradiction between evil and God. Well, we can give, I think, even more serious examples. So consider a case where two people want to do something unique. Say, two people each want to be married to a specific woman, or two people want to quarterback this year's Super Bowl champions, two people want to discover calculus, two people want to be the person who cures cancer, two people want to do any of these sort of things that we think are genuinely good, that you really ought to desire if you desire good things for yourself or for others. Well, you can't both get it, right? You can't have two different quarterbacks, at least two different primary quarterbacks for the Super Bowl champions. Two people can't be the first person to discover calculus. Okay. I've got other examples here. Comfort, right? Nobody could ever be comforted. Nobody could ever be forgiven. Nobody could ever be courageous without the threat of suffering or evil in the world. Likewise for art. I'm sure we've all had this experience where we observe a piece of art, say something like Schindler's List or one of Shakespeare's tragedies, and it is in some way or another painful, but it is nonetheless good. Okay. Well, there's another way to put the argument, in a way that is in some ways a bit more natural, right? So we'll start with this premise that I call PL, for pointless. There are evils that aren't necessary for a greater good, and God would stop these. So God doesn't exist. Right? Because remember how we got our response to the logical problem going. We started off by saying, some goods require evils. So God has a reason to allow those evils, because God's in the good-getting business. But if there are evils that aren't necessary for any greater good, well, then there's another way for the atheist to go forward. Okay. So here's the argument. We can see how this works, and we can say that, you know, this seems like a pretty good start. So how are we gonna establish what I call PL, namely that there are pointless evils? Well, we start by picking out an example, saying that was pointless. So take an example, example E, it's an instance of an evil. Then we say, look, this evil appears to be pointless. And if it appears to be pointless, then it probably is pointless. Now, what's being appealed to here is what's called the principle of credulity. You don't need to know the name, but most of the time, if you're walking around and you see something, right, it appears that I'm holding a black pen, you tend to think, unless you're given some reason to think otherwise, that this is a black pen. Unless you think that I've, taken out a blue pen's insides and like put it in there, you should think it's black. But if you don't have reason to doubt the appearances, you trust that the appearances are the way that things actually are. And this is a fine way of arguing for the most part. One thing that's worth noting, and I may go into this some tomorrow. I haven't quite figured out what I want to do with my next two presentations. I may change them a bit from last time I did this. Is it's worth asking, what does it mean to say that an evil is pointless? I said a bit about how it may not be required for a greater good. One of the things you might wonder about there, and I can say a bit about this if someone wants to know, but this isn't the main line of attack I'm going to advance against these arguments, is that does it have to be a single good that has to be greater than an evil? I mean, if we have an evil that's, say, evil to degree 5, but it allows us to get two goods that are good to degree 3. Is that pointless? I mean, it's not required for any good that's greater than it. Those sort of things are worth thinking about. But let's get on. Okay, the second attempt is appeals to this no known goods principle that I have in KG. And the idea here is that, look, think about a given instance of evil, and then ask yourself, look, what sort of goods do you know of that require that evil, or that sort of evil? And if you can't think of any, then probably no goods at all require this. And there's a typo. Okay. Here's the sort of example that Roe has in mind. Suppose in some distant forest, lightning strikes a dead tree, resulting in a forest fire. In the fire, a fawn is trapped, horribly burned, and lies in terrible agony for several days before death relieves its suffering. As far as we can see, the fawn's suffering appears pointless. Doesn't it appear that premise PL of the argument is true? I think at this point, you should be thinking, man, this argument seems pretty good. I'm not sure how we're going to respond to it. I've got three different routes of response here, and the second and third tie together to some extent. Here's the most common and most well-known response. This is what's called skeptical theism. And the basic idea here is that if there were justifying goods, if there were a good that required a particular evil, or that justified the existence or allowance of an evil, it's not obvious that we would know about them, right? God is presumably a little bit smarter than us. And in that case, we probably don't know everything that he's up to. Why events happen in the way that they do. He does. He's got the... He sees the whole of history. He knows how events interlock. He can see what would happen and wouldn't happen if he were to remove a given evil, or what would probably happen or wouldn't happen if he were to remove a given evil. But we can't see that. There's a sense in which, for us to say, God wouldn't allow that to happen, to assume that God... is to assume we know more about how God governs the world than we probably do. But here's the sort of slogan principle here, right? If E is expected, E isn't evidence for the unexpected. And the idea here is that if theism were true, we'd expect some of these evils that we don't know what they're for. They're for something, all right, but we don't know what they're for. Okay. More precisely here, theism is going to object to the premise I called PLA earlier, which is that a given evil appears pointless. Right? So this is going to grant that Rose got the argument, the form of his argument is perfectly fine, and if all the premises were true, the argument would be good. But it wants to say the evil doesn't seem pointless. I take an evil like the Bambi case, Bambi getting burned in the forest. And we say, look, it doesn't seem pointless. Rather, it seems false that that seems to be the point of it. Or that there's some... it seems false that there is... It's false that it seems to us that there is a point to it. One way to see the difference between this is to imagine... a case of elephants, right? When you're in this room, you look around, you don't see any elephants, right? And so it doesn't seem that there's an elephant in the room. So it seems okay to infer from it there doesn't seem to be an elephant in the room that there probably isn't an elephant in the room, or that it appears that there are no elephants in the room. But this doesn't hold for other things like, say, bacteria, right? Doesn't seem that there's any bacteria in the room, right? If you think it does seem that there are bacteria in the room, point one out to me. I'd like to stay far away from it. But from that failure to seem as though there's bacteria in the room, it doesn't follow that it appears that there are no bacteria in the room, right? It would be irrational to believe there's no bacteria here. Sorry, germaphobes. The difference here, or at least a natural answer as to why there's a difference, why it failing to seem as though there's an elephant is reason to think there are no elephants in the room. But it's failing to seem as though there's bacteria in the room is not a reason to think that there are no bacteria in the room, is that we wouldn't expect to see the bacteria if there were any bacteria. We'd expect to see the elephants if there were some. Similarly, the skeptical theist is going to want to attack the no-known goods premise here. It's not that of all the goods we know of, we know that they don't require a given evil. Rather, we do not know of any particular good, you know, one that we can point at or grab or say, you know, that good requires E's occurrence. It might, but we don't see the connection between it. But that's different than saying, we know of this one that it doesn't require that. Okay? Are people tracking here? I know I'm going over a lot of stuff. This is, people feel like you have a handle on it? Anybody got a question on how this works at this point? I like to save questions for the end, but we're about to shift to a different thing, and I want to get questions on how this goes before we get to the next one. If anyone has some, you can also save them to the end.
So, in the end, all evil must have some sort of purpose?
So, that's a question I can address at the end if you like. That's debated, whether evil has some sort of purpose. Here's a quick answer, no, right? No, because you're free. And you are free to do things that don't serve any purpose whatsoever. That's going to be at the heart of at least some sorts of free will responses. Now, it'll require that it would be worse if God were to stop you from being free, or at least stop you from being free every time you wanted to do something bad. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the evil is going to be non-pointless. It's going to depend to some extent on what you think it means for an evil to be pointless, as I said earlier. Because you might think that if you could get the good without the evil, it would be pointless. Even if the evil is in the end outweighed by another good. Okay, does that get what you're saying? So, what I'm dancing around here is this question of, does God have to create the best possible world? Is an evil required for the best way of getting a particular good? If you like the free will defense, your answer is probably going to be, no, this isn't the best possible world. Because we screwed it up. But that's a little bit of foreshadowing to what I'll say tomorrow. What do you have?
How do you draw the distinction between moral evil and the problem of pain and suffering, which we see played out in the book of Job?
So at the moment we're dealing... Good. At the moment I haven't drawn that distinction. At the moment we're discussing... we're primarily focused in on suffering, right? So the evil of allowing... the evil that Bambi suffers when he gets burned and is lying there for weeks, you know, before he finally expires, is suffering. It's not necessarily a moral evil. Now, these are connected because we typically think that suffering provides us a moral reason to eliminate suffering, right? If I see somebody suffering and I can say, give them some Tylenol or you know, much stronger painkillers to alleviate their suffering, I have a reason to do that, and if I'm good, I'll do it.
So you're really talking about suffering as a result of natural causes.
At the moment, I'm just talking about any evil whatsoever. The case we are given is a case of natural evil. And one of the reasons that Rowe chooses that case is because he wants to avoid the whole free will defense.
So what's the responsibility in those natural causes? Because if I decide to build my house in a place where there's it is prone to earthquakes,
right,
and we know according to science the movement of tectonic plates actually protect us on this earth. But if I, and I think John Lennox referred to this as the external ring of fire, if I put my home in a place that I know is prone to those disasters, then I have to live with the consequences that are going to come from an earthquake or a volcano.
Well, so that's definitely something to be considered, right? We'd all think that when you decide where to live, you need to take those sort of things into account. However, not all sorts of evils are like that, right? Bambi didn't choose where he was going to live. And even certain disasters, right? There's hardly a place on Earth where you can get that there is no chance of there being a natural disaster that could wipe you out, right?
But I mean, don't we typically assign evil to something that has intrinsic worth? No, we eat animals.
Well, so I would think, okay. I'm going to have to pin this one toward the end. We can raise this at the end, but I want to make sure I get through everything. One thing I'd say, though, is that if you think the suffering of animals provides you some reason to... I mean, if the response here is going to be something like, animals just, their suffering doesn't give us more reason to alleviate their suffering, then Roe's going to have to find a new example. And perhaps he can. But if you think that the suffering of animals does give you a reason to eliminate their suffering, and I think most of us, at least before we start thinking philosophically, want to endorse that principle, and I'd say I want to endorse that principle now, even after having done some thought about it. You're gonna want to be able to say something about how the argument, given that sort of example, is going to fail. And I think a second point here is that it doesn't always matter what's right. So Doug Grotheis began his thing about doubt last night, if you came to it, with the example of Steve Jobs. Look, whether you think the answer to Steve Jobs' question, did God know this evil was going to occur beforehand, is yes. I think, and this may get me in a bit of trouble, I think it would have been better to say, you can think not, if the alternative was him turning his back on Christianity. You don't always have to get people to believe the truth, because on some questions, they are just bound and determined to accept things that you think are false. Sometimes what you need to show them is that Christianity or theism can accommodate beliefs that they're just bound and determined to hold on to. But we will get on to this. Obviously, that can't be done with every example, right? If someone's bound and determined to think that Jesus didn't die on the cross or wasn't resurrected, that's just not going to fit with Christianity. But I think on smaller examples, like, say, what sort of things have intrinsic worth, presumably the truth of Christianity and theism shouldn't hang on that. But let's get on. I know I've now said, like, way lots more than is immediately relevant to this, and I'll be happy to answer this either in Q&A or after Q&A if this comes up. But for the moment, I just wanted to see if anybody had questions about how the argument was going so far. I think people are tracking with it, hopefully. Okay. So, to recap, so far we've seen the problem of created evil. And it failed because you can respond that evil isn't created. It's not a thing that exists independently. We saw the logical problem of evil, and it failed because there just isn't a contradiction between God allowing evil and God creating the world, being omniscient, being omnipotent, being holy good. Now, so far, now we're looking at something that wants to take instances of evil that strike us as pointless, strike us as needless, strike us as the sort of things that we really wish the world didn't create, or didn't contain, I'm sorry, and ask why would God create a world that does contain them. Okay, now, so far the skeptical theist has said, well, look, we don't know why the world creates it, or why the world contains it, I'm sorry, but God may very well have had a good reason for creating a world that does contain it, and there's not any reason to think that we would know what that reason is. Okay? So skeptical theism is not going to provide an answer to why this is, or why there are evils like that. But what it will do is undermine the argument from those sorts of evils, from evils that strike us as pointless, so that we might be tempted to describe as pointless, to the conclusion that God doesn't exist. Okay. Now, this isn't, I think, the strongest response to Roe's argument. It is, however, a response that applies to most any sort of argument from evil. Because there are variations other than Roe's. And so I think it's an important one to have in your toolkit. And I think it's good so far as it goes, although that's been somewhat controversial recently. Here's another response you can have to Roe. Okay? This is Alex Proust's response. And he thinks that Roe's argument is invalid. There's a fallacious inference in there. What he thinks has gone wrong is that the move from apparently A to therefore probably A, while it's good in general, it's not good when you're considering a theory that's supposed to explain a wide range of phenomena. Here's a way to think about it, right? Start with an assumption, right? Every galaxy has a black hole at its center. Okay, so that's our assumption. We're going to start with that. Now, galaxies come in different shapes, they come in different sizes, and we have better and worse viewpoints of different galaxies, right? Depending on how they are situated relative to us. So it's reasonable to expect that given this variation in their location, given the variation in their size and shape and all these sorts of things, that there would be some galaxy that apparently lacks a black hole at its center. Now we apply the inference from apparently A to probably A. First we just name our galaxy, G. And then we apply this from apparently A to probably A inference, and we get the conclusion that probably G lacks a black hole at its center. And from that we can draw the conclusion that probably the assumption we began with is false. But something seems like it's gone wrong here, right? Sometimes you can start with an assumption and then reason your way to the assumption being false, and that's what's called a reductio. But that assumption, if we can do that, needs to be necessarily false. It seems like it's entirely possible that there is a black hole at the center of every galaxy. We shouldn't be able to reason this way. Something looks like it's gone wrong here. And what's gone wrong is that when we're, or so Proust thinks, is that when we're dealing with these arguments of the sort, arguments that make claims like every galaxy has a black hole at its center, finding one outlier doesn't do it. One case that doesn't seem to conform to our theory doesn't strongly disconfirm our theory. So what Rho needs to do, or so Proust thinks, is it needs to establish a different sort of claim than the one that Rho's after. What's really important when you have these all X are Y theories, all evils are purposed for some good, for instance, is you need to say something about the expected instances of disconforming cases versus how many you actually get that seem to disconfirm it. So here would be a good argument against our black hole theory. If every galaxy had a black hole at its center, we'd expect that X percent of galaxies would appear to lack a central black hole. In fact, Y percent appear to lack it, and Y is greater than X. So probably there are galaxies that lack a central black hole. So that would be a good way to go about it, but it's not clear what we can say about or how we can apply this to the argument from evil. Exactly, supposing for the moment that all of the evil in the world has some good or another that justifies it, how many cases should we expect where we can't see what that good is, or where the good or where the evil appears to be pointless? I think it's sort of hard to say. And here's a second question. How do we determine how many and to whom an evil must appear pointless? How many apparently pointless evils there are and to whom they must appear to be pointless? And so this is what I call a subjective theodicy, or where what I call a subjective theodicy comes in. Now, if this is possibly a valuable approach, then establishing how much apparently pointless evil there is in the world is going to be a subjective enterprise. Subjective in the epistemic sense, not subjective as, well, it all just depends on what you think. Not relativistic, but it's going to depend on what sort of evidence you have available to you, and some of that evidence may not be available to anyone else. To put it more precisely, here's a couple of claims that I think are pretty plausible. Some goods display a radically subjective character, that is, they are goods that can only be recognized by the subject for whom they are. And if you're given a sufficient number of evils experienced by a subject, and provided a sufficient number of those of sufficiently weighty evils have been defeated by some greater good that is radically subjective, that is, the agent can recognize it, but it's not the sort of thing that an outsider looking in can see as defeated. S is justified in believing that any instance of suffering is defeated by some greater good, displaying a radically subjective character, or at least withholding his dissent, his assent. Yeah. At least withholding his assent from the denial. Okay. Let's put that in English. If in your experiences evils are with some degree of regularity defeated by goods that others can't recognize, you're rational in doubting the claim that a given evil is pointless. Maybe it's just justified by a good you can't see. So the thing that initially got me thinking about this is, after Hurricane Katrina, there were a lot of cases of people trying to explain why Katrina happened, right? I remember packing up, going to a church, hearing somebody ask in church why it happened, and getting the answer from someone else in the congregation, that was to punish those people. And in some sense, they have a very good, very tidy, very neat theodicy. Look, those people in the French Quarter needed to be punished, and the most effective, non-miraculous way of doing that was a hurricane. And if, you know, a few other people happen to get hurt in the process, well, I mean, really, none of us are good at bottom. You know, total depravity. Throw some of that in there for spice. Of course, there were lots of atheistic explanations for why this happened also. Namely, look, it's about air molecules, heat, cold, blah, 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 and we don't need to ask further questions because there is no God controlling these things. And you know what? That wraps things up pretty nicely. But in the weeks and months following my experience, at least, of Hurricane Katrina, and something that was in many ways traumatic for both me and my family, I came to believe that, you know, though I'd gone through something that was tough, that involved a great deal of suffering, it was at the same time justified. I think I came out a better person because of that experience than I would have otherwise. I think I had the opportunity to help people that I would not have otherwise. So, if that's the case, if this sort of reasoning is, if that's the case, then I think I'm in some position, at least with, say, similar evils, to be a little bit suspicious of the claims that, look, you know, that forest fire in California, that earthquake in Taiwan, that mudslide in Honduras, whatever you like, that was pointless. There was no good that could come of it. I think a lot of times, there are goods, but the goods that come of it are ones that we just can't see. Or at least, I think that's something that, for those sorts of things, I'm in some way in a better position than either our atheist or our punishment theodicists to say, you know, that doesn't seem like that gets at the sort of goods that would be involved here, if any there were. Okay, couple of thoughts. We do often employ this sort of reasoning. One of the examples I used a while back when my parents were here was that Freud, when he came up with his whole Oedipus complex story, he did that because he took like a year off and just reflected on his internal self. And then he came up with this theory about how men in general are, that men in general want to kill their fathers and marry their mothers. And it certainly seems weird, but this sort of assumption that our experience is not anomalous is in general, and in absence of evidence to the contrary, a good one to make, I think. We often make this same sort of assumption, or this same sort of move when questions of value are involved. Sometimes we'll ask people, look, in hindsight, looking at how that turned out, was it worth it? And we're willing to accept whatever answer they give us. A third point I want to make is sometimes the radically subjective goods aren't necessarily goods for the one who has suffered. Consider statements like, you don't know how you've touched me, you don't know what the courage you displayed in going through that has meant to me. This seems right. And sometimes we may have confidence that an evil has been defeated, even if we can't tell by what. I remember that things worked out for the best. I remember that overall it was worth this is sort of the same. This isn't, I think, any more mysterious than going to a restaurant and remembering, man, that steak was worth what I paid for it, even if you don't remember what the exact price on the bill was, or even if you don't remember exactly how big the steak was or what all the sides you got were. Sometimes we just remember that the outcome of something was worth that something. Okay. Now, one of the things that's worth asking here is exactly how much evil and how weighty do the evils have to be to get someone to be able to say, of any evil whatsoever, they're justified in just withholding assent from the belief that it's pointless. I think that's not going to be a clear line, but I think we can give clear cases where it is. So my favorite case here is Horatio Spafford. He had 5 children at one point. His son died in 1871. 2 years later, he put his wife and all of his 4 daughters on the Ville de Havre and shipped them over to America. He later received a telegram, that said, "Saved alone. What shall I do?" And in passing over that very spot where the Ville de Havre went down and only his wife was saved, he wrote, "It is well with my soul." Now, I don't think I know exactly what it takes to do that sort of thing and write that. But I don't think I'm in any position either to judge him irrational for coming to that conclusion, that whatever my lot, life has taught me to say that it's well with my soul. And if that's correct, if I'm right in thinking that we're not in a position to judge him, then I think that same sort of thing can apply to the more mundane struggles that we have. And I think in some sense, the non-mundane struggles that Christians have in dealing with something as ubiquitous as, say, indwelling sin. But that's what I've got to say about that. And I will now take questions. So, that's a lot of stuff about the problem of evil. We can take questions. Yeah.
Now, you go to Cornell, right?
I do go to Cornell.
Well, since I'm a Southern Baptist from the South, I just figure that's a bunch of godless homosexual atheists. So, do you meet...
Okay. So I've never had a Q&A start that way.
They're communists. And they're communists. So,
okay.
In your everyday life, you know, you're in the academic circles. Right. Do you meet people who are atheists who buy into the Rose and Mackies of the world? Or are they thinking, oh, you know, planning to beat them out? I mean,
So it's an interesting question. So part of the thing to realize about philosophy, I'm in the philosophy part, is that it really varies depending on what you study. So I know a lot of people, everyone who's considered the problem of evil after Plantinga has more or less agreed that Mackey's argument failed and that Plantinga showed it failed, and that where the action is now is in probabilistic arguments. Now, do people know this? Well, you get a lot of people who are just sort of focused in on their own area of philosophy. So I've got some people who are they just do philosophy of language, and they haven't really considered the problem of evil. So, for instance, there's an epistemologist, not at Cornell, and I'm not going to tell you his name, but I saw a comment on a friend's status once who goes to the school where this guy teaches, that, you know, I'm not a theist, but, you know, I don't really have any arguments. My only real argument is that belief in God is a little embarrassing after Auschwitz, but I wouldn't really make that argument seriously, like, in public. So what sort of version of the problem of evil is that? It isn't really any particular version. So it depends, you know. Different people go different ways on it. The one thing I will say, in defense of my communist, atheist, homosexual whatever friends, is that by and large, at least in philosophy, I have found we don't have a lot of people who are sort of Hitchensians or Dawkinsians in how angry or anti-theistic they are. They might think there are good arguments against theism. They almost always think it's the bottom of evil that's a good argument. But most of them seem to be pretty open to the idea that theism's a respectable position. Maybe there's even some good arguments for it. So it's not nearly as antagonistic as you would think. It tends to be people who don't know nearly as much about philosophy as they think they do, and like to write books about philosophy, that think that it's overwhelming evidence that belief in God is false. Yeah.
Earlier you said that free will allows for some pointless evils.
It depends. So it's going to depend on exactly... Yeah, it will depend on how you think of free will. It'll depend on how you think of pointless. But I think that the typical free will response that you get does allow for pointless evil.
My question is, how does this affect the more deterministic views that some Christians have?
Right. So if you come back to my free will thing, I'm going to offer a sort of free will for compatibilists. Now, if what you're really asking is about Calvinism and Arminianism, the answer is it's a lot more complex. And here's why. Because you can be a non-determinist about free will and nonetheless be a Calvinist. It's entirely possible to be either a Molinistic Calvinist or to think that belief in God, coming to faith in God, are special cases. And so although God determines the will in those cases, that's something different than what happens in the majority of cases where you exercise your free will. So it's going to depend. If you think about free will in a deterministic way, it's going to be harder to give a free will response. It's also going to be probable that your free will response will not be one that involves pointless evil. Again, maybe. Depends on what you mean by pointless. You can offer, for instance, Felix Culpa story where the fall is the sort of thing that is going to be, in the end, beneficial. This is accomplished via free will, and so it's all for the better, but the explanation for where evil comes from is still going to be our free will. And so the basic line will be something to the effect of, we're better off for being the sort of creatures that would fall, even though we were determined to fall, and even though it's still a fall, even though we were determined to fall. So there's a lot of moving parts when you start discussing free will, especially if you also have an eye towards theological questions. But the basic answer is that it's basically libertarians about free will who are going to get pointless evils out of their free will defense. Now, maybe you think that's good, maybe you think that's bad, but I think that's basically how it's going to go. Now, second thing is, you might get... if what it is for an evil to be pointless is for it to be an evil that doesn't exist in the best of all possible worlds, you might be able to get that for free regardless of anything that has to do with free will. But again, it just sort of depends. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
How would you suggest dealing with somebody who doesn't reject God because of the problem?
Right.
So they have a general belief in God.
Right.
They think there's pretty good reasons for God. And then they take a look at Scripture and
right.
say, well, I don't think God, who is
right.
loving and exists, would send anybody to hell or tell two people who love each other they can't
right.
get married. What's a good apologetic for that specific to Christianity?
So I think that those are going to be different questions, right? There is a question about the problem of hell, which is going to be closely related to the problem of evil. And it's just going to depend, because how you justify hell can go in lots of different ways depending on what the person wants. Some of these you might not like. So you might, on the one hand, just think, look, you don't have to be, you don't have to think that people go to hell to be a Christian. You can think that the as through Adam all men fell, so through Christ all men are redeemed, or something like that. So what I don't recall exactly what the verse is. You could think that that verse gives you reason to be a universalist. Now, I'm suspecting you don't like that. Another way you can go is you can spend all your time talking about justice, right, and engaging in a moral argument about justice. Now, that's not going to be quite the same thing as engaging in a, say, a theodicy or a discussing, you know, what sort of reasons God has for this. That's going to be a question of, is this the right thing for God to do? A different thing you might do is you might try and take some of the bite out of hell. So you might, for instance... I think a lot of what gets people about hell is they think that hell, if you go to hell, it's worse to have gone to hell than it would have been to never exist at all. And I think that's false. But you don't have to think that's true. Nothing in the scriptures commits you to thinking that's true. And if you're thinking, wait, what about what God said to Judas, what Jesus said to Judas, you know, it'd be better for him never to have been born. Well, look, I can tell right now from what you think that you think that people exist before they're born, right? So maybe the way to read that is just that it would have been better for him to have been, to die before his birth. There's no reason you can't read it that way. There's no reason you can't read what he's saying as a bit of exaggeration. I mean, Jesus exaggerates all the time. You know, if a man does not hate his father and mother, he cannot follow me. Or he'll say things like, let the dead bury their own dead. If all you have is that one verse, you don't necessarily need to, you don't need to think that it's better to never exist than it is to go to hell. So there are different ways you can go at it. They're all, I think, viable options on that. On the issue of you know, why would God keep two people who love each other from marrying, I think that one's just going to be a matter of moral argumentation. You're just going to have to talk about ethics there. It's not. Put it this way: if what you think as a Christian is that, look, God would have allowed two men to marry each other, except that there's some good that requires him to forbid that, you've probably lost the argument already. Like, that's not, I think, how you want to think about marriage. That some of these things really are marriages that they get kicked out because there's some good hanging out there that forbidding these things, which are actually marriages, is going to accomplish. That's not the way you want to go. So that's just going to be a separate question, I think. Yeah.
Just think about this practically. When you have someone who's literally just faced, like, because it's great that when you have someone who's literally faced with those problems, like the very last illustration with the man who had lost his family. So it seems like the first response is, and I think you kind of alluded to it, yes, evil is here, it happened. In the end, the relationship I have with God is going to help to compensate for that. Like, let's not think about the possible good or whether it's pointless or not, but just the fact that the relationship with God that I want to help you have, that can help you overcome any experience that you're having with the evil.
Right. Well, so I think it depends, right? That, again, a little bit of discernment on that sort of thing is going to be required. If the person coming to you has suffered significantly more than you have, put it this way. One of the very natural things to do in apologetics, and I think this is a good thing to do, is when someone comes to you struggling with the problem of evil, that you try and meet, or struggling with any problem whatsoever, that you try and meet them where they are by bringing your experience to theirs. I think that's a good thing. But there's also a time where you also want to be careful, on the other hand, not to trivialize their experience. If they're coming to you because, you know, let's say their whole family was murdered, and the best you've got is, you know, yeah, I was really sad when my cat died. You better take a different approach. It just isn't going to work. Scripture does give us, and the Christian tradition and history gives us cases of people who have gone through these and come out the other side. And I think for people who are in intense pain like that, part of what they need to know is that there is another side to come out to. And I think part of what you need to know in engaging with these people is there isn't a quick other side to get to. If somebody's coming to you because they've had extreme evil in their life, you're not going to talk them out of it right now. Sometimes the only thing you can say is, I'll be there with you, and I'll suffer through this with you, without saying, let me argue at you. Because sometimes people just don't need that. Sometimes people just need you to be there with them and care about them.
Take them to process it.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who went through very much this, came out of a very fundamentalist background, has all sorts of problems, has PTSD and things of the like, PTSD, depression, and all these sorts of things, and she needed both of these. She needed someone to tell her, look, here's how you can make sense of evil rationally. But she also needed somebody to say, you know what, it's okay with me if you're an atheist. We're still going to be here and we're still going to love you. And she didn't come back to where I am, right? She's not a Protestant. But 2 years ago, she was confirmed in the Catholic Church. And I count that as a win. And I count that as God doing something. But it's only the sort of thing that's going to happen if you're willing to meet them where they are and suffer with them through these sorts of things.
So does that make sense also for apologetics to try to unearth the question under the question? Because sometimes some will ask the question and it's really not that primary question that they're after.
Yeah, look, you always have to address what... in apologetics, even just in conversation in general, you have to address people where they're really at. Now, sometimes... that's harder than in other cases, right? It's not. One of the things you need to know, right, aspiring apologists, people who are coming to this thing, it's not a good idea to launch into here's my argument when they meet you. The first thing you need to do when somebody says, hey, I've got a question, is figure out what their question really is. Ask them, why do you think this is a problem? Get at what's really going on, right? And sometimes that just means getting clear on what their argument is. Sometimes it means getting clear on what's motivating their argument. But if you're just charging in gung-ho, you may like knock down a really nice philosophical argument and, you know, make some subtle moves and undermine this argument that they don't give a crap about. That doesn't have anything to do with what they thought rationally or what was going on existentially. So as much as I'm trying to equip you to deal with people's arguments, I also want you to understand, slow. You've got to go slow. It's nice. We all want to have the sort of immediate conversion experiences with our friends and coworkers and everyone where we can do it and the scales will fall from their eyes and that will be it. Life will turn around. It's just most of the time not like that. People take a long time to change, and if people have the sort of objections that apologetics is for, it's going to take a long time. And sometimes you won't see the result. Sometimes all you can do is get them to be open to the next person. Okay? So as much fun and as interesting as apologetics can be, it's very important to understand this is a slow road. It's the road you have to take in America a lot of times, right? Because people have heard so much absolute garbage about theism and about the truth and rationality of Christianity that you've got to get through it a lot of times. But it's a good road, and people that go through it can come out this out as people who contribute a lot to your own development and to the Christian community. Okay. next question.
In regards to like apologetics and evangelism, like how soon, whenever you're sharing these arguments with somebody, how soon do you make the connection with the cross, you know, the cross mm-hmm. of Christ? Or do you just kind of, you know, backpedal and
so,
try
yeah.
to avoid the, you know, coming to the
cross? Yeah, so my advice is I don't ever try to avoid the cross. It would be a mistake, I think, to try and say hide what you believe on a subject. Sometimes it's worth telling people, well, I don't think this is right, but here's something you might think that's okay. I think since our ultimate goal is to make Christians, not just theists, sometimes we have to, I think since our ultimate goal is to make Christians, not just theists, we do want to get to talking about the cross. But I think that's the sort of question you just can't answer in the abstract, right? What is it, sometimes it can be helpful to people to get to the cross early, right? Someone who's lost a child, you know, God lost one. That can help. But other times, it may not. Other times, they need to know more about you. They don't want to know about, they don't want to hear about Jesus. And that may be because there are other things that are blocks there, right? They may have questions about the historicity of Jesus, the historicity of the Gospels. They may have questions about the resurrection. They may have questions about blah, blah, blah. That's just the sort of question that I think you're going to have to deal with on a case-by-case basis. And maybe somebody who's more experienced and more knowledgeable than me can give you a better answer. But so far as I can say, if you're answering questions like, when do I get to... I don't have a good answer for that. I think you got to... That's going to be the sort of thing you just got to apply discernment to and talk about when you feel is right and as the Spirit leads you. But it can vary widely.